Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Today's reality check, politics and the military. Hello again, I'm Aaron Alney, and this is To the Point. Military strength and defense spending have been political footballs in every presidential campaign since before the Second World War. Now, the U.S. spends more on troops and weapons than the next nine countries combined, while Donald Trump insists we're weaker than ever. But insiders say Hillary Clinton sounds more likely to resort to force in foreign struggles the U.S. can't resolve or escape from once it's entangled. We'll hear where the candidates stand, not just on traditional preparedness, but on the future of warfare in the cyber world. On our talking point later, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine are now household names, at least for the moment. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. The most powerful military in the world is not big enough for Donald Trump, although Hillary Clinton's considered more likely to use it and to intervene overseas. We'll continue our reality check on the presidential campaign today with military strength and preparedness. On our talking point later, both sides are claiming victory after last night's vice presidential debate in their first and only face-to-face confrontation. Mike Pence and Tim Kaine accused each other of insults and lying. First, the news update. As Hurricane Matthew heads for Florida, President Obama canceled today's campaign appearances there. From the headquarters of FEMA, he issued this warning.
Matthew could soon affect areas all across the southeast. So at my direction, FEMA has been on the ground in Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, working with state and local officials to prepare for the storm. I want to emphasize to the public, this is a serious storm.
The governors of all those states the president mentioned are warning people to prepare for the worst, but the island nation of Haiti might already have seen it. Brian Concannon is director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He joins us from Boston. He is in touch with people in Haiti. Brian Concannon, thanks a lot for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Warren. It's good to be with you.
145-mile-per-hour winds. We understand an important bridge is out that leads to the southwestern peninsula of Haiti, where a lot of people live in very strained circumstances and where the harvest was about to begin.
Yes, we don't have a good idea on exactly what has happened in terms of damage to that. It's pretty well known that those kinds of winds, and even worse, the rain, which was predicted to be 15 to 20 inches, will cause catastrophic damages. But with the road out and with telecommunications and other communications down, the information coming from that area has been very sparse. In terms of the death toll, the reports have been coming in single digits. You're hearing 5 people died here, 10 people died here. That would be spectacularly low if that held up, but we are afraid that as more reports come in that it's going to go much higher. There's widespread report of crop damage, as you mentioned, which that's going to cause hardship and deaths down the road as farmers can't afford to feed their families. And also just many houses, tens of thousands of houses are flooded and then at least partially destroyed. So there's going to be fairly massive displacement.
Trees knocked down, roofs torn out in poor, largely rural areas. And you say tens of thousands of people may be turned into refugees.
Yes, at least temporarily. It'll depend on how quickly some of those houses can be repaired. A lot of the houses, rural houses, are relatively simple and easy to repair. And if the resources can be deployed quickly, and if the roads are open so that resources can be deployed quickly, that homeless situation can be fixed. But many, a huge percentage of the families are going to lose at least something. Either they're losing some farm animals that they were counting on to pay school fees or medical bills, the crops, just having houses flooded and losing all of your possessions. It's going to have a pretty severe toll aside from the death toll on families. Another thing we're deeply worried about is cholera. Haiti's had a cholera epidemic since 2010 when the disease was introduced by UN troops, and there tends to be spikes in cholera when there are spikes in rainfall, and this is the greatest of all possible spikes in rainfall, so we are bracing ourselves for a large spike in cholera, not just in the southern peninsula, but throughout the country, which did receive some pretty heavy rains.
You say UN troops were responsible for introducing cholera. That's one of those tragic ironies. What about the resources you indicated will be necessary? Do they come from the UN too?
The UN has said it has things ready to deploy, both in terms of material, but also doing some funding appeals. The President Obama announced that he's going to stand ready to help Haiti. I'm sure there'll be many countries in the world will make some contributions to Haiti. It's too early to say how much that's going to be. No one is actually saying numbers. And another important part of that, as we learned during the response to the earthquake, is that not only does money have to be sent, it has to be spent well. Hopefully the lessons have been learned and that this time there'll be much more consultation with Haitians on the ground, with the Haitian government, better coordination of aid, and it will be expended in ways that are more sustainable than happened during the earthquake, which led to some disappointing results.
And we don't know how much there will be damage in the United States that might draw attention away from Haiti, even though the winds there are much stronger than what we're likely to experience in Florida and the rest of the South. Very quickly, if you will, I understand an election was planned in Florida, in Haiti. What are the chances of that actually happening?
They just an hour ago they announced that they will not be happening, which was not a surprise to anybody. The Electoral Council can't announce when they will be postponed until they say they need another week just to see what the damage is in the country. And there's talk about trying to do it by the end of this month or early November, but it's really too early to tell. That's problematic because most Haitians were these elections are far delayed, and most Haitians were looking forward to moving forward. But most people do not see this as catastrophic, more as an inconvenience than a very serious problem.
Ryan Kankanen, director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Many thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
In a moment, today's reality check, politics and the military. On To the Point from PRI.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In 1960, Democrat John F. Kennedy accused the Republicans of allowing what he called a missile gap. But it turned out the U.S. was way ahead of the Soviet Union. Here's what Republican Donald Trump has been saying about American strength today.
President Obama and Hillary Clinton have also overseen deep cuts in our military, which only invite more aggression. Really, we will have aggression like you've never seen before. And you've got it already happening. Our adversaries are chomping at the bit. History shows that when America is not prepared is when the danger is by far the greatest. We want to deter, avoid, and prevent conflict through our unquestioned military strength.
And here's Hillary Clinton denying Trump's claim about military weakness.
It's just not true. We do have more work to do to continue to have the strongest, most effective military in the world. And here's what we have to do. We can't lose our military edge. That means giving the Pentagon the stable, predictable funding it needs to make smart investments.
Tom Bowman reports from the Pentagon for NPR News. It's good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Sounds like two different worlds.
Indeed, it does. Listen, you know, this is, you know, pretty common that you would have, you know, a Republican hitting the Democrat on, you know, not spending enough on the Pentagon. When you listen to Donald Trump, his campaign calls for really focuses more on hardware and people. He wants tens of thousands more soldiers and Marines, more aircraft, more ships. We're talking tens of billions of dollars more for defense. Now, Hillary Clinton doesn't talk about defense in that way, so it appears she's on board with the reductions in the Army and Marines called for by the Obama budget. She looks at it a bit differently. She's looking at investing, she says, in innovation and capabilities, like having the military be able to develop systems to communicate and attack in a more coordinated way. And she also talks about preparing for what's known as asymmetric threats. And that would be, of course, threats like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, enemies that don't have large standing armies or navies. So part of this is, you know, just a difference in philosophies, I guess.
Difference in philosophies, but also a practical difference as well. What would Donald Trump do with all the new hardware and people that he wants to pay for?
Well, we don't know. I mean, as he said, that he hopes if you create a larger military force, you're sending the message to adversaries that they won't mess with you. Well, that was not the case with the attacks of 9/11. It wasn't the case when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and the U.S. went in to kick him out. So I'm not sure if that really makes sense in today's world where you do face these asymmetric threats from people like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They're not going to be cowed, I would believe, by creating a larger army of maybe 40,000 or 60,000 more. So the question also is, how do you pay for it? He talks about cutting back on waste, fraud, and abuse. He talks about also cutting taxes. So how do you make all this work is a big question. The other thing is the sequestration, the across-the-board budget cuts in the defense and domestic areas. Both candidates, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, would like to do away with that. But, of course, Congress would have to go along with that for large increases in the defense budget.
So as a candidate for president, you can say what you want, but of course the Congress has a role in all of this, including the power to declare war. How likely, or it's my understanding, let me put it that way, that people in the Pentagon think it is more likely, despite what we've just heard, that Hillary Clinton would in fact intervene overseas than Donald Trump.
Yes. You know, just listening to what Hillary Clinton has said, talking to some of her advisors and so forth, you do get a sense that Hillary Clinton would be more aggressive. And she talks about, for example, against ISIS, intensifying the current airstrikes and also stepping up support for Arab and Kurdish fighters on the ground. But no details on that. Of course, Donald Trump talks about, you know, kind of a America First strategy, not getting entangled overseas. You know, he criticizes NATO for not paying enough. So it's much more of you don't want to call it an isolationist stance, but clearly not as eager to get involved overseas unless it's against ISIS. He has also called for more stepped up stance against ISIS, a much more aggressive military stance against ISIS. And he said that, listen, if he gets into the White House, within 30 days, he would like a plan from his generals on how to soundly and quickly defeat ISIS, in his words.
Okay. We heard last night in the vice presidential debate what he has said about generals. Sometimes he says he'll fire them. Sometimes he says he'll ask them for their advice. Sometimes he says he knows more than they do already. Yeah, again, Tom Bowman is a Pentagon reporter for NPR's National Desk. Philip Lohaus is with us. He's a defense and national security analyst at the American Enterprise Institute, known as a conservative and hawkish institution. Philip Lohaus, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Is Donald Trump right that despite all the money we're spending already on the military, even though there are some reductions going on, that the United States is actually weak?
Well, I don't think that the United States is actually weak, but what I will say is that the decisions made by the Obama administration over the past 8 years have given the impression that the United States is far less willing to follow up on what we would call credible deterrence, right? So, you know, the example that we typically point to is the Syria red line and how nothing really happened with that. And all we have to do is look at Syria now and the administration's discussions at the UN just very recently about how catastrophic the humanitarian situation is in Syria, which I think we'd all agree with. The fact of the matter is that the administration's actions or lack thereof have actually contributed to that situation. So these are things that people, foreign actors, observe and you know, make decisions based on that. And I think one could draw a line from the reticence of the Obama administration's lack of willingness to get involved in certain foreign contingencies to Russia's increased aggression to South China, to China's increased willingness to build out islands in the South China Sea, and other things that we're seeing around the world. So, I mean, when I read some of these different proposals and I see Trump trying to, you know, increase the numbers and everything, I have to respectfully a little bit disagree with Bowman. I think that, you know, increased numbers isn't really aimed at deterring ISIS. It's aimed at deterring Russia, deterring China, at deterring conventional actors that have actually become much more assertive in the past 8 years.
So what about Trump's suggestion or lack of suggestion that he would actually take action? He has said, as Tom Bowman just indicated, a sort of America first kind of a policy. Is it you talked about giving the impression that the United States is not willing to get behind its credible deterrence. Is it really then a question of policy and what you do with what you've got rather than what you've got enough?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to – there are a lot of things I don't agree with respect to Trump's approach and to his overall characterization of the threat and things like that. However, what he's actually put forth, his plan, I think, actually is somewhat sound in terms of the increase. And especially in talking to advisors, the plans to really increase military readiness, I think, are really sound. And, you know, of course, the real question is what does he do with all those tools? And that question really kind of remains an open one. But I would have to say, too, we have to ask that about Secretary Clinton. We don't really know what she would do either. And in fact, I would say that her plans have been even more vague than the Trump administration's regarding how she would continue things. I mean, we can point to certain advisors that she has, people that we think will be involved in the administration for an idea. You know, she obviously talks about investing in technology and military speak. That's like the third offset. So obviously that's a priority for her. But we still don't know about either of the candidates, how they would use these tools when they actually are in the Oval Office.
Tom Bowman, back to you. What about the point that the idea is not to deter the relatively small asymmetrical type groups in the Middle East or even people like Saddam Hussein, but rather Russia and China and other major adversaries?
Well, I think what Trump has said is that no one will mess with us. I think that's how he put it in so many words. So I don't think he's distinguishing between ISIS in Al-Qaeda, in Russia, in China. So, I mean, that's what he has said. But let's face it, I mean, even if you create 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 more troops, you know, will Russia just kind of roll over? Will they not be more aggressive in the Baltic states, for example, Ukraine? We don't know now, and we won't know then.
Gordon Adams is with us. He's now professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. He was the senior White House budget official for national security in the White House of Bill Clinton, former president. Gordon Adams, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
Do you agree with the Philip Lowhouse that it is, in fact, sound, as he put it, to increase spending on both troops and military equipment?
No, I don't. But I think I want to start, Warren, by saying that the picture that Donald Trump has portrayed of the American military and is too often portrayed during campaign seasons and especially during budget seasons, which is where we are on the military, is a simply inaccurate picture of the state of the U.S. military. The U.S., as the chiefs have regularly testified, have the strongest and most agile and most ready military in the world, and they have the U.S. military is the most global. We have global intelligence, communications, logistics, transportation bases. No other military in the world even tries, including the Russians and the Chinese, to match what is a hugely dominant American military capability, whether you're counting money, equipment, forces, or technology. Those things are fundamentally baseline wrong when you say that it's in shambles or it's unready or it's non-existent or needs beefing up. None of that is truly an accurate description of the American military. But the critical question about the military buildup, as has been suggested already both by Tom Bowman and by Philip, is what is it for? What do each of these candidates think they want to use the military for, right? So setting aside the question of experience, because I think experience is not the issue here, it's not at all clear to me, as has been suggested already, that Donald Trump would be a non-interventionist against nation building when at the same time he talks about being more confrontational towards China, stepping up to what's described as a Russian threat, and we can come back to that, seizing Iraqi oil, bombing ISIS, scrapping the Iran agreement, which could only lead to a risk of heightened conflict and probably ground war in Iran. So Trump may have some positions that sound non-interventionist, but the reality is he's kind of a bully. And he's easily inflamed. And some of the things that he said could easily lead him as president to misuse the American military. And even Hillary Clinton, I would argue, can get us into trouble because she is very much an exceptionalist, a globalist, the indispensable nation. She supports a no-fly zone in Syria, the Libya intervention, and so on. Either one of these candidates could misuse the American military and get us into trouble by either more interventionists like Hillary Clinton has supported in the case of Iraq, or by an instinctive knee-jerk response to a confrontation, which is what we might get with a President Trump.
Tom Bowman, back to you at the Pentagon for National Public Radio. Is the Pentagon worried about what we just heard, misusing the military and the forces that the Pentagon controls in a way that would, as Gordon Adams put it, get us into trouble?
Well, I don't think the Pentagon speaks in one voice, of course. I think clearly when you talk to generals and admirals, and as I have over the years, what they want is a clearly defined goal. What are you going to do? What do you want us to do? And, what is the exit plan? They want something clear, if possible. I mean, that's the big thing you keep hearing at the Pentagon. And they don't want you to keep changing the strategy or the mission once something starts. I think that's a frustration you may have seen with Pentagon officials and generals and admirals over the years.
Tom Bowman, again, with NPR. Thanks a lot for joining us. I know you need to leave us, and we're delighted to have you with our program, and you got us off to a great start. Many thanks.
Okay, thank you, Warren.
Philip Lohaus, back to you with the American Enterprise Institute. Just to get the second half of our conversation going, we'll pick it up after we take a very brief break. What about the idea that you need to have a clearly defined goal? Has either of these candidates indicated clearly what it is that he or she wants to do with America's military power?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is no, they really haven't. I mean, and just to talk a little bit about ISIS, I mean, I thought the assertion by the Trump campaign or by Trump himself that he wanted to have the generals come up with a plan to defeat ISIS right after he got into office. I mean, that sounds really great, and I'm sure that his base really appreciates that, but I'm sure that the generals already have a plan to defeat ISIS. The question really becomes, what is your end goal, right? How do you match what we talk about in the strategic studies community, means and ways and ends, right? So if your goal is to defeat ISIS, are you willing to do what it takes to do that?
Well, very quickly, is that something that would get us into the kind of trouble that Gordon Adams referred to if we try to, for example, set up a no-fly zone or in another way confront Russia, which you indicated is a huge threat that we ought to be worried about?
Sure. I mean, of course, I mean, it complicates the situation, right? I mean, it could involve all those things. And doing a no-fly zone, especially at this point, would be an incredibly contentious decision. But again, if the goal, the role of the president is to set a clear goal, right? That's the role of the executive, of the commander-in-chief. And the generals will decide how to actually accomplish that goal. But if the goal is to defeat ISIS, then, Hillary's talked a little bit more about this. She wants to basically continue maybe ramp up the amount of airstrikes and do the no-fly zone. So, but basically, you know, rely on special forces, not really get ground troops involved, things like that. And it's unclear whether that'll actually answer the mail in defeating ISIS. And even if it does, we don't know what the end game is after that, right?
Okay.
And that's maybe an even more important question.
All right. Philip Lohaus again with the American Enterprise Institute. We'll continue with him and Gordon Adams at American University, formerly with the first Clinton administration. administration, and we'll also speak about cybersecurity and the wars of the future and whether we're prepared for those. In the meantime, we'll take a brief break. On our talking point later, Mike Spence and Tim Kaine are now household names, at least for the moment. This is To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Well, and only back with To the Point, as the campaign for the White House hurtles on, we are doing another reality check, this time on military strength and preparedness. I want to go back to Gordon Adams, formerly with the previous Clinton administration, as National Security Advisor in the Budget Advisor, I should say, in the White House. Gordon Adams, both of you have mentioned a no-fly zone. It was my impression last night, listening to the vice presidential candidates, that both campaigns are in favor of the no-fly zone. Does that mean, in your opinion, that either one of us could get us into what you refer to as trouble?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things about Syria, I mean, let's look a little bit at the Syrian problem. The Syria problem is not one of those problems that is amenable to solution by the use of American military forces. As we know, there are multiple militaries operating in Syria, starting with Assad, including the Russians, including Hezbollah, including the Iranians, including the Syrian opposition, including Nusra, including ISIS, all of whom, the Turks, you name it, none of those forces are capable of prevailing. All of those forces are more based in the region than the United States. The real questions the Americans have to ask themselves, I think, is whether something like a no-fly zone or direct strikes on the Syrian government, on Assad's forces, are likely to solve the problem or get the Americans in deeper without the ability to solve a problem. And a no-fly zone contains exactly that kind of risk. A no-fly zone, especially with the Russians operating in the theater, runs the risk of confrontation with Russian aircraft. It will require out-of-country support operations and in-country support operations for spotting, directing attacks, assessing battle damage. All of those things introduce more American military directly on the ground in Syria. And the American people have to ask themselves if that looks like a good answer, given our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the same, I think, could be said, actually, for the Russian problem. It's not clear, as Tom Bowman suggested, that adding even 30,000 people to the size of the American military is going to be something that in any way deters Putin from what Putin intends to do on his own border. The last time I looked, the people who really failed invading Russia were Hitler and Napoleon. It's not a desirable military objective. And therefore, you have to be much more refined in policy. What are the things that actually will send clear messages to Putin? How do we understand what Putin really wants? And do those actions mean greater military capability or different relationships with our allies? And there, of course, Trump is in trouble because he said some highly critical things about the NATO alliance, not exactly reassuring to the NATO allies. So the fundamental bottom line question here, Warren, is are the military options the right options? What can the U.S. military do? And I think arguably here they cannot go to war with Russia. It's undesirable on both sides, and I think Putin knows it. In fact, the Russians have fewer people in their active duty military than we do, which reverses the Cold War situation. They have about 800,000 people in their military. The U.S. has 1.4 million in its active duty force. Complete reversal of the Cold War era. I don't think Putin wants to take that thing on or provoke that thing. And in the Syrian case, it's pretty clear, at least to me, that it is a mess, and that's a technical term, and it's one that is only susceptible to working through as the forces on the ground figure out the balance of power and as the diplomacy tries to surround it and bring it to a halt. And it's a difficult, hard slog.
Philip Lohaus, back to you with the American Enterprise Institute. Here we are now in Syria, described by Gordon Adams as a situation that we simply cannot resolve, but with the military options at all. And I'm interested in your response to that, because I think you indicated you were in favor of increasing the size of a military, which, as we just heard, is already bigger than that in Russia.
Right. Well, a few points. I mean, first off, I'd just like to say that, you know, I I agree with the level of complexity that the no-fly zone would bring to the table for American policymakers. And I think it's a really good example of details that we're not hearing in this current debate from either of the candidates. The situation that Dr. Adams just laid out is a good example of, you know, it sounds really good to the American people to just have a no-fly zone. I mean, of course, yes, stop the bombing, right? But in reality, it's a lot more complicated than that. And it has a whole laundry list of second, third order effects that simply aren't, that the candidates either don't want to talk about or don't know about. It's difficult to know, especially in the case of Mr. Trump. But with respect to, comparing Russia and American force sizes is a bit of apples and oranges kind of thing. I mean, the United States has global military commitments. Russia doesn't. We have the issues that we would need to address with respect to Europe and everything are just one tiny part of our portfolio, which is global in reach. And nobody's saying that Russia is global in reach. They're simply interested in leveraging advantages around their border. I would agree with Dr. Adams, though, that we need to really carefully define what it is that we what the threat is that Russia is causing, and think of ways to leverage our current alliances to better counter that. Because as he was suggesting, our allies that border Russia have much more at stake in this situation than we do. And Mr. Trump's consistent kind of talking about NATO in these very transactional terms really kind of belie the importance that our alliances bring, not just for our allies, but also for the United States and for the way that we handle our international security commitments.
Okay. As you said, and as our listeners undoubtedly will remember, we are not hearing the details from either side about what they want to do with the military, perhaps because they get into the kind of conversation that we're involved in now, with very few answers appearing to be on the near horizon. Let's talk about something that involves the future. The United States has now announced, I believe it's the FBI, that it has arrested Harold T. Martin of Glen Burnie, Maryland, who was a worker for Booz Allen Hamilton, the very same consulting firm that Edward Snowden worked for. And Mr. Martin has been arrested for stealing government secrets of a very important nature. Elias Grohl is with us. He's a staff writer at Foreign Policy. He covers cybersecurity, privacy, and intelligence. Thank you for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
What does this illustrate about America's weakness 30 years into the era of cyber warfare?
The arrest of this NSA contractor is a fascinating turn in what's been a summer of rampant computer insecurity. You know, we've seen computer breaches at the Democratic National Committee, followed by the posting of files stolen from those servers that resulted in the firing of W. Wasserman Schultz, the Democratic Party chief. And we are seeing, you know, we've talked a lot about this on the show about Russian aggressiveness, and we're seeing Russia exploit these kinds of weaknesses in computer systems for their own advantage. And it's very unclear how the United States and these presidential candidates that we've been talking about might respond to this in such a way that they could try to rein the Russians in. Now we see the same kinds of computer security problems bedeviling the National Security Agency, the American Signals Intelligence Agency. And it's the second time in 3 years now that a Booz Allen Hamilton contractor has allegedly walked out of Fort Meade with very sensitive information. Edward Snowden was also a contractor for Booz Allen Hamilton. And I think what this arrest shows, if man ends up being convicted, is that it's extremely, extremely difficult to keep information safe in this era of having computers everywhere.
We don't hear it talked about by public officials, and I believe it's probably highly classified. But we did, in fact, in the case of Iran's nuclear facilities, interrupt them, apparently, with the Stuxnet virus. Could we do that again in response to Russia? Are we better at this than the Russians might be? And should we respond?
That's a question that the Obama administration is thinking very hard about right now, and they haven't really been able to come up with an answer. U.S. officials say that the National Security Agency and U.S. Cyber Command is basically unrivaled in its ability to strike computer systems around the world. In theory, yes, the United States could probably strike back at Russia and do some sort of damage via a computer program. Sure. Do they want to do that, however? That's what they haven't figured out. This is a totally new realm of warfare, and how these cycles of escalation, how processes of these kinds of tit-for-tat responses where one country does another thing and another country responds to try to get them to back down from the position that they have just taken, how that exactly works in cyberspace is very unclear. And you're now hearing on the campaign trail from both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton that they are going to come into office and be more aggressive. Donald Trump is saying that he's going to be more aggressive than Hillary Clinton. No surprise there. And Hillary Clinton has also said that she's going to come in and take a very strong stance toward Russia. But again, it's very unclear what that exactly looks like. And it's a question that the White House is looking at very closely right now and that they haven't really been able to come up with an answer to.
Gordon Adams, let me go back to you. You said the United States is stronger than Russia in so many different ways. Is it stronger in cybersecurity or cyber warfare as well, particularly given what we know about Stuxnet, which didn't just stop a computer program or mess it up, but actually interfered with the centrifuges that were being used to produce nuclear fuel?
I wish, Warren, it were easier to answer that question. But were it easier to answer that question, we would have to have a lot more public disclosure about U.S. cyber offensive capabilities. We hear this issue commonly and for a good reason, discussed as defensive capabilities. We are being intruded upon. We need to defend our systems better. This discussion that's going on now with the apparent Russian intrusions has raised the question of offensive capabilities. The reality is that for at least the last 15 or 20 years, the United States military has actively been developing offensive cyber capabilities. The Stuxnet virus was not a unique one-off in terms of what the American technical capability here is. The research program has been highly advanced. It's also highly classified. And it's been easier and perhaps more politically convenient for the military to talk about defensive capabilities. In fact, one head of the Central Intelligence Agency, NSA, encouraged testimony. This was Keith Alexander, encouraged testimony that would emphasize the defensive problem precisely because it was unwise to talk about U.S. offensive capabilities. So your question cannot be answered except in the general sense, and that is that the United States has been developing for some time a serious, long-term, both tactical and strategic offensive cyber capability, as have the Russians, as have the Chinese, as have most major technologically advanced countries, and even a few movements have sought cyber capability. So the real question here is, what do you do back, and how do you deter? So we have an, if you will, a sort of a nuclear relationship here with nuclear deterrence. How do you deter in the cyber world where everybody depends on it, everybody around the world? And so the one issue that I think this administration and the military and many other countries have not taken at all seriously, since everybody depends on this stuff, is what kinds of international regimes need to be established, like were established for air traffic control, like through treaties were established for arms control with respect to nuclear weapons, like the law of the sea agreements and so on. Are there international regimes where the common interest in avoiding disaster is so great among the nations of the world that they have to find ways to define those agreements? And we're absolutely at the starting point of that search.
Elias Grohl, back to you. Given what we've heard about asymmetrical warfare and about cyber warfare as well, is the time coming sooner rather than later when, in fact, the kind of traditional military that we've been talking about elsewhere in the program, troops and planes and boats and tanks and all of that, will become essentially obsolete, or at least a lot less important than what you can do with cyber war?
No, I think we're pretty far from that future. It's very alluring to think of that kind of techno future for warfare, if you will. But I think that the future of warfare looks much more like cyber warfare being a component of larger, more traditional military operations. So, you know, let's say you are trying to carry out strikes inside the territory of an adversarial nation, let's say North Korea, and in order to take down its air defenses, you hack into its radar systems and take out the radar system, allowing your planes to continue unmolested into North Korean airspace and carry out a strike of that nature. So rather that cyber warfare is a component of traditional warfare and is slotted into a larger military structure, rather than cyber warfare kind of consuming the whole military and taking over warfare as we know it. That might happen one day, but I think we're very far from that future.
So, Philip Lowhouse, back to you with the American Enterprise Institute. At the very outset of our program, we heard a soundbite from Hillary Clinton where she said, "We have the strongest military in the world, but we do need to make smart investments." Should we assume that by that she means we should do more with cyber war and warfare, I should say, for the reasons that we just heard described? And is it, in fact, then something that ought to have a very high priority?
Well, I definitely think it's something that should have a high priority. And, you know, I think that we can infer from what she said that, yes, cyber will continue to be a high priority for her. But, you know, I think, like, because we are, I agree with the other guests that we're at the very kind of early stages of learning how to think about cyber warfare. There are a lot of other factors that come into play aside from just research and development, right? So regarding the offensive capabilities, you know, it's one thing to have the capabilities, and obviously we can't get into classified discussion, but I'm pretty confident in our offensive capabilities. But the willingness to actually use those capabilities is different than just having those capabilities. And I think that's something that the current administration is struggling with. And I think that, you know, a lot of administrations in the future, not just the next one, but probably the one after that as well, will struggle with too. And, you know, the interesting thing too about cyber warfare is it's not just this high-end offensive capability that kind of complicates things, that adds to the dimension of warfare that Mr. Grohl was speaking about. It's also low-end types of capabilities, right? I mean, it's not just taking down a mainframe or stealing information. It's also, I mean, we've seen Russia do this with its, the New York Times had a great report talking about what they call the agency, which is this factory, this Russian-sponsored organization in St. Petersburg that essentially employs people to help change narratives across the world through Twitter and through Facebook and things like that. So cyber is not just about, like, taking out mainframes. It's also about how do we change narratives? How do we leverage populations and things like that? And that's something that's much more complicated, and that, you know, R&D alone is not going to provide the answer to that. We also have to think about, like, you know, what is it that we're trying to shape in the cyber realm aside from just, you know, these in other words, we shouldn't just think of it as a military weapon. It also has to do with information.
Okay. Once again, a reality check, this time on military strength and preparedness, a conversation that we won't hear on the campaign trail, even though we might like to. Thank you all very much for being with us. Philip Lowhouse at the American Enterprise Institute, Gordon Adams, now at American University, formerly with the Clinton White House when Bill Clinton was president, as the senior White House budget official for national security. Elias Grohl with Foreign Policy, where he covers cybersecurity, privacy, and intelligence. And we didn't have time to talk about privacy, but that's another issue that certainly arises. And our earlier guest, Tom Bowman with NPR. Thanks to you all. Great to have you. Mike Pence and Tim Kaine surprised the prognosticators in last night's vice presidential debate, introducing themselves to the voting public with a lively set of exchanges. Will it make any difference, though, in the presidential campaign? Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. This year's vice presidential candidates, hardly known to the voting public in general, were limited to just one debate in the campaign for the White House. They are both experienced political pros, former Congressman Mike Pence, now Republican governor of Indiana, Tim Kaine, former Democratic governor of Virginia, now in the U.S. Senate. Here's an example of how it went last night. The first voice is Tim Kaine.
If you want to have a society where people are respected and respect laws, you can't have somebody at the top who demeans every group that he talks about. And I just, again, I cannot believe that Governor Pence will defend the insult-driven campaign that Donald Trump has run.
And here is Mike Pence.
If Donald Trump had said all the things that you said he said in the way you said he said them, he still wouldn't have a fraction of the insults that Hillary Clinton leveled when she said that half of our supporters were a basket of deplorables.
Dave Weigel is covering the vice presidential nominees for the Washington Post. Hi, Dave. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Okay. The Wall Street Journal has editorialized that this was Donald Trump's best debate. He wasn't even there.
I think that's fair. But it's good for Trump in a way that he cannot replicate, because the defining characteristic was Mike Pence, who is not Donald Trump, saying that quotes uttered by Donald Trump were not real, and that's going to be tougher for Donald Trump himself to do. I think the aftershock of this debate, too, is showing that you can get away with some of this if you're not Donald Trump, if you're a Trump surrogate, as we see on cable, unfortunately, every day. You can kind of get away with saying, oh, you say Trump say that, but I don't believe that he did. You cannot get away with that on the replay, and at the same time, you can't really get away with that in a debate format if you are Donald Trump himself.
Trump is famous, of course, for interrupting and inserting comments while other people are speaking. Last night, it was the Democrat, Tim Kaine, that did more of that than Pence did.
It was, but he was trying to make points each time he did so. I think you could tell that it was a tactic he started to use at the very beginning. I believe he got the sense that it wasn't working because it wasn't rattling Trump. Remember, Hillary Clinton did the same thing to Donald Trump, not interrupting, but kind of laying traps and laying landmines is the word I was looking for, waiting for him to get slipped up and angry. And I think Kaine did that for about 20 minutes and gave up on it. But every time he did interrupt, it was trying to make an aside, correct something Pence had said. I'm remembering the number of the new employed, the poverty rate, et cetera. He would insert that, as opposed to Trump, who would just throw in a word like wrong or an aside that's not being turned into a campaign ad when he says not paying taxes, if he did so, made him smart.
So one of the things that you have written is that Pence tried to convert more voters into amnesiacs. Elaborate a bit on what you meant by that.
Well, that's what I was trying to say before. There is basically a difference in how conservative voters and liberal voters read the news. There has been for a while. I'm not the first one making that point. I'm just watching it happen in this campaign to an increased degree. And among conservatives, if you only consume talk radio, maybe Fox News, maybe articles people send you online, and you'll never hear the other side of what Trump said, the things Pence was denying, these quotes about the Vladimir Putin, quotes about women, et cetera, you would like to believe that they were taken out of context, right? And I think Pence was trying to do that. What Kaine did, I'm kind of ripping off Ian Millhiser at the Center for American Progress, who made this point first. Kaine did was more of a deposition, where he wasn't going to grind down Pence on TV in that moment, but he has a record to go back to that Hillary Clinton can go back to that will hurt Trump in the long run. And their bet, and just Democrats view the media differently, their bet is that people will go find out the truth for themselves. I mean, you hear in this debate, you heard Hillary Clinton in the last debate several times said, go check it out for yourself, go to the fact-checking website. You notice that you did not hear Donald Trump or Mike Pence say that, because they're kind of counting on people to say, well, this image I saw on TV was very trustworthy, I'm going to leave it at that.
You've said in your story this morning that there was a clash of realities last night, and that as far as Pence was concerned, he was shameless in the way he attempted to deny what Trump had been saying. But is that going to work to either side's advantage, or do you think that they kind of came to a draw last night when it comes to actually having an impact on the campaign?
Well, I don't know how it's going to move anything. the Republicans are going to optimistically say this stopped the slide that they did have, and the effect it might have is there might be frustrated conservatives who dropped off from supporting Trump after the last debate who say they're more excited now. One thing you saw after Hillary Clinton's performance was a big surge in Democrats saying they're motivated to vote this year, and that didn't just close her polling gap. That vaulted her ahead in enough states to win. See, you might see that in the short term, but I'd refer to that deposition analogy because I think it's a good one, and this is the last time, frankly, a lot of people might think of Tim Kaine and Mike Pence. The next time they see Hillary Clinton, she has this record to rely on, and she can say to Trump, what you've done and said is so outrageous that your running mate can't even defend you. I'm happy, proud to stand with mine. Your running mate denied that you said this, denied you said that, denied that you believe this. I think that's one thing Kaine did more than Clinton did in this debate, advancing the narrative, was trying to bring attention to Trump policy statements on nuclear war, on taxes, on Social Security, things like that. I think that is what Clinton might do next. So it was more obvious to me where Democrats are going to try to take this in the next debate. I just don't know how you can pivot off what Pence said. In the spin room last night, you're standing around and you hear what other reporters are asking. You're not clipping their notes. You just kind of can see the narrative shaping around you. And people get, the ones who were with positive spins on it just kept saying, oh, is there something Donald learned from Mike Pence tonight? Well, it's hard to repeat what Pence did because he was refusing to defend somebody who's going to be there on stage defending himself at the end of the week.
So you call this a clash of realities and also a clash of two theories about media and politics. Who got the most sound bites out of this thing, do you think?
That's a good question, and that's why Democrats don't really view this as a loss. They would have preferred a big domination, but remember, they didn't get one in 2012. People remember that Joe Biden defeated Paul Ryan in the number one debate. It wasn't clear that they did. The CNN poll actually only had Ryan triumphing by 4 points. The CNN poll this year had Pence triumphing by 6 points. So that's the reason Democrats aren't worried about it, because there's really nothing that came out that's going to be a joke. I think Democrats, again, more than Republicans, talking about what media people consume, I think they do factor in what Saturday Night Live might do and what comedians might make of this. And right now, I think the impression is going to be of Kaine a bit jumpily being unable to believe what this guy is getting away with, and Pence pretending that Donald Trump doesn't exist, he's never met this person. I think in the Rosie Gray at BuzzFeed put it, like he's running with Mitt Romney, or he's running with a generic Republican, not with Trump. So I think there's not really one big quote, one big moment, like a Lloyd Benson moment. It's just the impression that what Trump does is indefensible, even by his running mate, is what they're going to run with.
Lloyd Benson telling Dan Quayle, you're no Jack Kennedy,
yeah.
I knew Jack Kennedy. Very quickly, what about the reality check here that they failed to respond in any way to questions about what they would do as vice president? It's a job that has gotten more powerful in recent years.
Yeah, that was a disappointment. The other disappointment, I think, for a lot of us who have covered either of these men is they have records and they're barely litigated. Mike Pence has a very conservative record. That was his claim to fame, was that he was to the right of Tom DeLay and John Boehner in the Congress. And as governor, has signed pro-life bills. That didn't really get litigated. Tim Kaine's record, would have liked to talk more about guns. That didn't get litigated. But both campaigns conceded before the debate started that these guys are both credible-seeming presidents.
All right. Dave Weigel with The Washington Post, many thanks. Great to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.